Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ruling today issued by the Commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, banning Donald Sterling for life from any association with the team he owns, the LA Clippers, fining him $2.5 million and moving to have a three-quarters majority of the NBA team owners force him to sell the Clippers. All this on the eve of an important playoff game for the embattled team. Andrei Markovits, a professor of comparative politics at the University of Michigan and author of Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, and Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States, joins us to discuss today's punishment of a racist billionaire slumlord team owner by his peers. Then we'll discuss the public shaming of Donald Sterling further with Andre Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. We'll discuss attempts by the right-wing press to label Sterling a Democrat, even though he's a registered Republican, and examine why, only weeks after Sterling's racist rant was made public, African-American leaders like the Reverend Al Sharpton and the NAACP were about to host an awards dinner honoring Donald Sterling with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Then finally, we'll assess the arguments before the Supreme Court in an important Fourth Amendment case with far-reaching consequences for privacy in the digital age. Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C., who was in the Supreme Court today, joins us to discuss how the court might rule on police powers in searching a potential crime scene where they have access to a trove of personal and private data, your cell phone. And joining us now is Andrei Markovits, who's a professor of comparative politics at the University of Michigan. His books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. His latest book is Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrei Markovits.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the press conference today with the NBA Commissioner, Adam Silver, I actually, just to give you my personal take on it, Andre, and I'm interested in yours, of course, I was very impressed with Adam Silver. I've watched a lot of press conferences, and this guy was the sharpest, the most concise, the most on point that I've heard for a long time.
Well, I could not agree more with you. I've not attended as many press conferences as you have, so I can't have sort of, other than watching a lot of them on television, I actually was not only impressed by what he said, but how he said it, and he clearly, he was really moved by this. I had the impression that this got to his core, and he reacted, he saw this ultimately as an absolute necessity, that there was no way to compromise, that he had to bring, all the possibilities that he had to bear to really purge this unacceptable entity in the NBA. This was really a sort of kind of it was like a purge. It was really that this is, you had to cut the body out, or this was really a cancer that simply just could not be in some ways sort of negotiated, or that's what was going on here.
So having written about how Uncouth Nation, why Europe...
Wait, please, be very careful, because it's about Europe's hideous anti-Americanism.
I understand. Being a little facetious, but I mean, yeah. My sense is that this is actually a great moment for America, because it really shows that the majority of Americans are decent and abhor this kind of language and this kind of attitude, whether it's in private or in public. I mean, the moral suasion that's happening here is pretty profound.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a good deal of my last 20 years berating Europeans about their hideous anti-Americanism. That's what Uncouth Nation is about. That to Europeans, Americans are simply uncouth, and it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would not see it in that context, really, other than that, especially in sports and especially in hegemonic sports, meaning those very few sports that are major public culture, meaning literally three or four games played by ball-like contraptions. So not the Olympic sports, but sports that people follow. The United States actually has had a much more progressive stand than Europe. I mean, you addressed Gaming the World, where in fact there's a whole chapter how in Europe, soccer world, the counter-cosmopolitanism, racism, the most hideous expressions of anti-Semitism, whatever, are actually par for the course. And that actually, in this case, the United States, or especially, by the way, the NBA, simply is miles ahead and had to be. And so which is not to say, by the way, that there is no racism in American sports and that there's not ugly forms above all of homophobia and all this stuff. After all, these are, entities that are owned by men, are played by men, are on and on, in which, of course, clearly partisanship is very important, and the whole idea about partisanship is to get into your opponent's head, and then it becomes really a matter of degree whether you can call someone an ugly bastard or whatever, that is acceptable, or you add a racial epithet, or you actually invoke Auschwitz. So that's really a slippery slope. But in the United States, for reasons which, of course, have everything to do with its history, in the last 30 or years or so, racism has become an absolute no-no. Not other forms of counter-cosmopolitanism, but racism has become a no-no. You cannot do that. I've gone to thousands of American sporting events and European events, but I have never heard at an American event. I've heard some very nasty things, but I've never, ever heard someone really berate a player with the N-word or in any racial way. You just don't. And this is absolutely common on all Europe's football grounds. So this is a difference, and yes, I think to come back to your earlier point, I'm not sure one should be really, patting one's shoulders on here or back of being sort of so virtuous, but I really think Silver did an amazing job. I must say I was really impressed, because I actually had thought that he would ban him indefinitely rather than come down with a death penalty, and which he did, and I was just dumbfounded. And what was so amazing is that how the tweets were coming out on the screen, and how the greats like Magic Johnson and so on really completely, and Shannon Sharp, the football player, famous tight end, Hall of Famer, and all of these guys just completely backed him. So a major victory for Alan Silver was one of my great professors at Columbia. Adam Silver, and this is a good day. I think it's a good day.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrei Markovits, who's a professor of comparative politics at the University of Michigan, and his books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and his latest, Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. But in Europe, at least, though, in terms of the soccer cups, etc., and the European Cup, the cup is awarded to the players and the captain, not the owners, whereas particularly in the NFL in America, the team owners seem to have a much, much more powerful and prominent role, as do owners in general. And it seems to me that that's more a comment on how America is so business-friendly.
I would be very careful with that. That's just a tradition. I could tell you how that arose. I mean, I'd be very careful. I would never go as far as an American owner having less power than Roman Abramovich or Silvio Berlusconi or the Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the Abu Dhabi owners of Manchester City. So be very careful. I mean, that just happens to, owners don't come right on the field to accept the cup, even though very quickly thereafter they're immediately interviewed. That's just a minor thing. I would not read any kind of major symbolic difference here. especially, you know, with the owners that exist also in Europe. And look, these sports teams, I mean, are probably one of the last bastions of sort of personalistic ownership, meaning they are run like corporations, but they're actually not corporations. They are really sort of personalistic fiefdoms. They are the playthings of rich people for whom this is an aspect of social capital. It's not money. Money doesn't, I mean, I know this is, of course, totally against everything that people say, but the New York Yankees or Manchester United are a piddly little corporation. They would not even come close to anything of the Fortune 500. Okay, that's not what their power is about. Their power is, in fact, about symbols, about culture. And that's why they are so coveted by the likes of Roman Abramovich or the Boss family or whomever, okay? Because, in fact, they convey a phenomenal form of recognition, prestige, all these other things which our societies value. But it's not for the money. You know, Mark Cuban doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter whether Dallas really makes, the Mavericks make a lot of money or don't make a lot of money. The last person to really have a sports team as his primary form of income and source of income in America was Calvin Griffith, who owned the Washington Senators and then moved them to Minnesota, and they became the Minnesota Twins. That was, you know, 50 years ago. Since then, all these owners have made billions in other things, or they have other interests, and then they have these. This is like a trophy. And that's not different from the premiership or from in the U.S., whether they go in for whether they are shown, the owners are literally shown with the trophy or not. I think that's really marginal. There are a little bit of differences in places like Germany and Spain, because these clubs are actually less, they're not owned by individuals, but by clubs, where you have the socios, the members, so it's a bit of a different model. Still, I just watched the Real Bayern game, and these are major entities that are all about symbolic and cultural and social capital, not financial capital.
But Andre Markovich, you just mentioned Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. Yesterday, he was defending Donald Sterling and saying this is an issue of free speech, and you know, people can say stupid things, but they shouldn't lose a team over an issue of free speech in a private conversation. He's now, of course, completely changed his tune since the press conference of the NBA commissioner Adam Silver. That seems to be out there in the one defender of the idea that this was a private conversation, which has been out there in the conservative press and defending Donald Sterling, was in fact the reporter from Fox News who asked that question. But Silver very quickly dismissed it by saying, well, it may have been a private conversation, but in our conversations with Sterling, he agreed that it was his voice and it was him that said it, and that's what he said. So end of matter.
No. It's nothing to do with free speech. I mean, he's not prosecuted. He can say anything he wants. But speech has consequences. It's not that he's not free to say anything he wants. He can say anything he wants. It's not his speech wasn't curtailed. It's what he said that has become, as I said before, socially unacceptable. Okay? I've just completed a book about how we have changed our ways of dealing with dogs and animals in general. It's about compassion. Okay, it would have not been odd or against the grain of the existing mores of the time. I don't know, 40, 50 years ago, for you to stand, somewhere in L.A. and kick a dog. This would have been fine. Try doing it today. Okay, it's not a question of it. Things have changed. Things have moved along. It's a question of demeanor, a question of probity, really, not about freedom of speech. He has every right to say anything he wants. It's just that it became public, and then it has consequences for not his personal freedom. He can do anything he wants, but in fact, it has consequences because he is in an entity where 75 or plus players are black. His employees are black, are African American, who take offense to this. So it's not. I don't think it's a free speech issue for me at all. It's just that there are certain markers that societies at some point actually, you know, see as you can't transgress against them. Whether, you know, and that's one of them. And clearly race is that in the United States, rightly so, given our history. And I don't see anything wrong with what happened here. He can watch the Clippers on television. He can do anything he wants. He can. And by the way, the issue about his potentially being forced to sell the team, cry me a river. Come on, he bought the team for whatever
$13 million.
It's valued now at $750 billion. I'm sorry, million. Excuse me, close to $1 billion. It's just, again, a form. It's a club. The NBA is a club. Clubs have rules. Any association, if you and I were to get together, we would establish certain written and unwritten rules. That's the way humans interact. And the NBA has a rule that, in fact, says that for whatever reason, above all, if you, in fact, violate and things by ill behaving that sheds bad, puts the association in a bad light, the association has certain rights to move against you. This is, any club would do this, okay? Any club, okay? And so the NBA just decided to, you know, he clearly put the NBA in a bad light, and I don't think anyone can argue that. And the NBA said, okay, you violated our club rules, we will take action against you. This is not a free speech issue. This is an issue that any association has, and he clearly violated those. Not only, certainly in spirit, I would actually even argue not only in spirit, but also in the letter.
Well, Andre Markowitz, you just mentioned that times have changed in this country, and of course that was the rationalization given by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, when he eviscerated the Voting Rights Act and said that racism is finished in America. But if you've been following the news lately, just in the last week, you had the Clive and Bundy situation where he was hailed by the right-wing press as a hero until his poisonous racism poured out, and then everybody ran a mile from him. The Supreme Court struck down affirmative action on campuses, and of course,
my campus.
Yeah, your campus, right?
Yeah,
the University of Michigan.
It's all about the University of Michigan.
Yeah, so
It's not about the campus. There are a number of cases. In this case, it was struck down the consequences of that, which in fact the Michigan voters then voted that it can be changed, the Michigan Constitution. But anyway, that's a whole. So what's your point?
The point I'm making is that the notion that we've changed has given conservatives cover by saying it's all over. And anybody that's paying attention to the real world, how can you say that after Donald Sterling, after Clive and Bundy, after the Supreme Court decisions on both voting rights and affirmative action, that racism is finished in this country?
Of course, I totally agree. But, I mean, you don't always respond to, you seem a bit obsessed by what the conservatives say or don't say.
Well, I'm with a liberal radio station. So.
Yeah, I understand that. But, I mean, it's you do what's right, you do what's important. I found this thing with this guy Bundy to go, I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, I do not understand how the federal government doesn't just, arrest the guy. I mean,
well, the reason they don't arrest him, Andre, is that he's got a bunch of armed guys with assault rifles ready to die for their right-wing beliefs.
Fine. I'm sorry. I mean, this is state power. I mean, you can't. If you and I were to behave like this, this wouldn't happen. Anyway, but that's a different story. I didn't say, or I certainly didn't intimate at all, that there is no racism. I just said that, in fact, in the discourse in sports, in hegemonic sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, the big four North American sports, certainly also soccer, which is not a major hegemonic sport yet in the United States, the discourse of racism has in fact been banned, okay? Meaning that to me, Adam Silver completely conformed to that. In other words, he basically said that we will not tolerate this, and I totally applaud that. There's end of story. I mean, this does not say that there is no racism. This does not say that race will not be the third rail in American politics. This does not mean that everything is honky-dory. Does not mean that a kid from central L.A. has the same chances as a kid from Beverly Hills, on and on and on. But, you know, different issue.
Well, Andrei Markovits, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrei Markovits, who's a professor of comparative politics at the University of Michigan. His books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. His latest book is Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with a further discussion on the public shaming of Donald Sterling. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrea Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. She's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. And in 2011 to 2012, she served as a Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrea Gillespie.
Thank you for having me.
And in terms of the politics of what's just happened vis-a-vis Donald Sterling and the NBA banning him for life and fining him $2.5 million and forcing the sale of his team, assuming they get the three-quarters vote, which the commissioner, Adam Silver, says they will get the three-quarter votes from all of them, owners of all of the NBA franchises. Nevertheless, I find it extraordinary that the conservative press is trying to tell us that Donald Sterling is a Democrat. The National Review and The Caller are putting this out. In fact, the National Review, his headline said, "Racist Clippers owner Donald Sterling has only contributed to Democrats." Well, the truth of the matter is he is a registered Republican and contributes to Republicans. Those are the facts. My sense is that when you have conservatives in this country continually telling us that racism is finished, and you've got people like Ann Coulter saying that liberals and Democrats are keeping racism alive, it would seem to me that just in this week, not only have we had the Sterling expose, we've had Clive and Bundy and his poisonous racist comments. We've had affirmative action struck down by the Supreme Court, the same Supreme Court who ruled and cut and eviscerated the Voting Rights Act, with the Supreme Court Justice himself, John Roberts, saying that racism is over in America. So it seems that Republicans want to tell us that racism is over and that the Democrats are racist. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, this just reflects the complicated history we have in this country with race. I think, you know, one, I think there's a sensitivity to sort of this being branded as all Republicans are racist or all conservatives are racist. They're not. I wouldn't make that claim, and most scholars of goodwill I know would not necessarily make that claim. And so I think people are not looking at Don Sterling as a Democrat or a Republican or conservative or a liberal. They're looking at this as a very powerful man who you know, abused his relationships with people and was in a and viewed his employees, the people who made him billions of dollars, as being somehow less dignified or less worthy of being considered human beings than other people. That's what's the what the problem is here. And so to try to inject partisanship or even ideology in this is a way to sort of deflect from the issue here. I think when we look at Donald Sterling in particular, this sort of reflects how people view racism in the United States. And for a lot of people, the perception that because codified discrimination is no longer legal in the United States, even with the pullbacks that we've seen the Supreme Court make with the Voting Rights Act, and in that Michigan case, the Michigan case said that the state, which had already banned the use of race in college admissions, was free to do so via referendum. So it's not actually a complete pullback on affirmative action. But there's this notion that with laws in place that say you can't discriminate against people, that that's all that the state can do, and so that this is more of a personal issue as opposed to a state-centered issue. Lots of people would disagree with that, myself included. And I think when we look at cases like Clive and Bundy, and even when we look at sort of the position that people like Don Sterling have in American society, this is way more than just personal prejudice. This is a person who made a lot of money off of the backs of black people, and he basically didn't want them to be seen patronizing with his friends and loved ones. And that seems very, very problematic. And this is somebody who maligned, in particular, one of the greatest basketball players to have ever lived. So I think a lot of people were deeply offended by that. And the nature of ownership in the NBA and the way their bylaws are written allow the other owners to take disciplinary action against him in the severe way that they did today. You know, if Don Sterling and the LA Clippers were just his own shingle that weren't part of this league, then the market would have to fully kind of take care of this issue by people saying, we're not going to work for you anymore, we're not going to attend your games, and you'll see sponsorships pulling out as a result of it. But because of the nature of the rules of the NBA, the other owners do have some leverage to try to put pressure on him to get him out of the way because it's bad for business for all of them. With respect to Clive and Bundy, I think that this is actually really important. I think we can see how people's personal prejudice can actually influence their ideas about government. So Clive and Bundy, you know, is one of those anti-government types who, you know, doesn't believe that the government should have any say over his life. And now there's this dispute over whether or not he was illegally profiting from using government land for his own business purposes. And so he doesn't view what he was doing as some type of subsidy, as some type of welfare. And so as an example to talk about what he did perceive as welfare subsidy, he brings up African Americans. And so, I mean, one, it's kind of hypocritical or ironic that he would bring up slavery, but you can see that his views about welfare, broadly speaking, and how he defined welfare, were very much influenced by what he perceived about African Americans and their use of it. And so oftentimes you cannot separate personal prejudice from people's policy preferences, from their voting behavior, and when they're in positions of power, from the policies and decisions that they make. And that's why this is still relevant today, and part of the reason why, if we didn't believe it before, we now have additional evidence that we're not in a post-racial society.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrea Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and was formerly an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman. Her current research focuses on political leadership of the post-civil rights generation, and she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. In 2011 to 2012, she served as the Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So I was very impressed with how the NBA commissioner handled that press conference. He was extremely sharp, extremely concise, and to the point. And he, I think, clearly felt personally affronted by what Donald Sterling had said. However, is there a possibility that he was facing a kind of players' strike? I mean, I wouldn't hold it against these players if they felt the need to boycott a league that had Donald Sterling in it.
Well, Adam Silver is a new commissioner, so this was sort of the first real test of his term as commissioner, so he really wanted to set a good precedent. There was a lot of outcry across the league from, you know, all kinds of players. And one of the things that amongst the African-American players that was really unique is that, you know, there are a lot of political and social viewpoints represented amongst the big marquee name players in the league, as evidenced by other issues where we haven't seen everybody come together. And there was a lot of unity about this particular issue. And so there was outrage across across the country, you know, from all types of people. And just sort of this, the level of racial animus that kind of came out of Sterling's speech, I think was really shocking and appalling to people. It wasn't, you know, just that he was yelling at his girlfriend for taking a picture with Magic Johnson, but he was forbidding her from bringing black people to his games. And in particular, because it was directed toward Magic Johnson, I think a lot of people, you know, very much took that personally. I mean, he's been a tremendous ambassador for the game of basketball for more than 30 years. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people took offense to that. You know, I think that part of the reason why he was able to do what he did today was because of the fact that the rules of the NBA that all the owners agreed to when they came in allow him to do that. If the LA Clippers were a completely independent team, there wouldn't be much that he, you know, could do for it. You know, the same way for, you know, a privately owned business, to the extent that they're following the Civil Rights Act and serving people regardless of their race, color, or creed, you can't necessarily penalize or take away a privately held business from someone. Somebody. But because they are part of a league where membership is a privilege, there's greater leverage on behalf of the league to be able to exert pressure and to punish owners.
But of course, this whole expose of Donald Sterling's true thoughts and private opinions, which some people have tried to defend on the basis that it was a private conversation, but Adam Silver quickly put that to rest when the Fox News reporter asked that question in defense of Sterling. He pointed out that it may have been a private conversation. However, he has verified with Sterling himself that it was his voice and those were his opinions expressed. So end of case. But this happened just before both the Reverend Al Sharpton and the mayor of Los Angeles were about to host a dinner under the auspices of the NAACP here in Los Angeles to honor Donald Sterling as Humanitarian of the Year. Those people surely have egg on their face, don't they?
Well, I mean, I think this is very much embarrassing for the LA chapter of the NAACP. I mean, if there's a takeaway lesson from this, I think we now have to sort of change the metrics by which we judge humanitarian work so that it has to be more than just doing certain gestures or even writing large checks, that people will probably from now on likely consider the totality of a person's relationships with certain types of communities. And so now that people are more aware of his attitudes, not just toward Magic Johnson or toward black men in general, but also towards potential tenants in his in the buildings that he owns and other types of things, I think one has to ask, before you give an award to somebody who may have done, you know, one or two good things, whether or not they are actually repentant of any of the troubling things that they would have done in the past. So, you know, were his donations and his outreach to African-Americans subterfuge for some larger prejudice? Was he making those gifts, you know, out of a sense of magnanimity, or was he doing so out of a sense of paternalism? And so, especially when you hear the part of the phone or the conversation with his girlfriend where he says, you know, well, you know, black people should, you know, have food. You know, it does sound very, very paternalistic. And so I think probably going forward, a lot of organizations will think twice, you know, about giving awards to people who have very, very complicated histories with the communities that they represent.
So in terms of a teachable moment here, Andre Gillespie, what do you think is coming out of this or should come out of this?
Well, I mean, I think for civil rights organizations, I think people will probably do a little more vetting of their potential honorees going forward. I think for all of us, when we think about the nature of prejudice, I think we look for obvious moments. And so the Bundy case and the Sterling case are really obvious moments of racism. We're still not having the serious conversations about the ways that structural inequalities still affect people's life chances and how those are highly correlated with race and ethnicity in this country. And so I think there are a lot of people who will still feel very comfortable that they don't make slavery references or talk about picking cotton all the time or say, I don't want black people showing up at, you know, my house or this, that, or the other. But you still may hold views that are informed by stereotypes that actually influence how you think about policy and other types of issues. I don't think that these circumstances have actually pushed us to having a real serious conversation about structural and systemic racism. And that's unfortunate because these guys will easily be dismissed as being marginal and fringe. And we won't actually look in the mirror and still confront the problems that still persist in our society with respect to race and ethnicity.
So in terms of your latest book, The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and Post-Racial America, what do you mean by post-racial America, given that we've had this conversation vis-a-vis attempts by the right-wing press in this country to say that Donald Sterling was a Democrat when, in fact, he was a Republican, and this whole idea that conservatives are the ones who keep trying to tell us that racism is over when it's clearly not?
Well, I mean, there are a number of liberals who I think took the Obama moment to assume that we were moving past race in American society. So I don't want to put all of this on conservatives or Republicans' feet. We use the term post-racial in the title of my book in my previous edited volume in part because it's a ploy to sell books. So I actually don't have editorial control over the titles of my book. And in both books, I make it very, very plain that I don't believe that America is in a post-racial society. But when we look at younger politicians like Senator Booker, like President Obama, they make conscious choices to try to de-emphasize race in their self-presentation and how they talk about things. Not that they don't care about racial issues, and they very much do, and if you know, ask them what they think about issues like this, they are very open with their opinions, but they tend not to talk about race to the extent that previous generations of black politicians did. And because of that, they're perceived to be more electorally viable, especially for statewide and national office. So the larger point of my book was to talk about what are the implications of framing oneself in a more race-neutral fashion in order to reach out beyond the African-American community to be able to win votes.
Well, I must say that Obama's comment on Sterling, I thought, was extremely on point.
Absolutely, and we've seen him be a little bit more forthright on race in his second term than he was in his first term. But generally, President Obama tries to present racial issues in a more transcendent sense. And so he doesn't always talk about race explicitly, whereas if you looked at earlier generations of black leaders, if you looked at somebody like a Congressman John Conyers or Congressman Charlie Rangel, they would have probably led with race, and Obama reacts to racial issues, and he comes out, as most people would say, on the progressive or right side of issues, but it's not necessarily what he's going to lead with. So nobody is questioning, whether or not he can accurately sort of pinpoint racism by any stretch of the imagination, but that's just not his style to kind of be the one to take the lead on it. He'll respond to questions about it, he'll answer, he clearly is sensitive to these types of issues, and will say the right things about race. But he has gone to great lengths and strategically so, some people might argue rightfully so, made a point that he's the president of all America and not just the president of black America, because there are some who would criticize him for catering to blacks if he did otherwise.
Well, of course, he couched it not so much in terms of race, but in terms of ignorance. And what's your sense, just in closing, Andrew Gillespie, of this moment in America? It does seem that the majority of American people have stepped up here and said that they disapprove of what Sterling said, what he stands for, and they approve of what the NBA have just done.
Right. I mean, and that's because this was so just blatantly offensive. So the question becomes, what happens when it's not so blatantly offensive? What happens when, from a matter of perception, you have differences of opinion and they fall on racial lines? What happens if the prejudice that's being expressed, either through coded language or through subtle gesture, is something where it's not so easy to sort of identify it as racist? How will America react, and will they try to restructure American society, law, rules, processes to be more equitable? That's the bigger rub. I think these are kind of slam dunk cases. These are obviously racist, and it's really easy for everybody to condemn them. But the challenge that we have in the 21st century is being able to identify and remedy the less obvious forms of racism, prejudice, and discrimination.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Andrew Gillespie.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University. Formerly, she was an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. And she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and Post-Racial America. And in 2011 to 2012, she served as the Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing issues before the Supreme Court today in an important Fourth Amendment case involving your cell phone. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Rotenberg, who's the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice to be with you.
And you were in the Supreme Court today, Mark, when there was a hearing on Riley versus California, a case that arose out of the arrest of David Riley, who was pulled over in 2009 in San Diego for an expired registration. The police found a loaded gun, and then when they looked at his smartphone, they saw that he was associated with a street gang, and he was then linked to a shooting and was convicted and sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. But I take it beyond this particular case, this has tremendous Fourth Amendment implications, does it not?
Yes, it does. What the Supreme Court decides to do in this search case could have implications for really anyone who carries a cell phone in the United States. According to the Pew Research Group, approximately 9 out of 10 Americans do carry cell phones. And the numbers of people who are arrested are also quite high. The Department of Justice said in the past year it was over 12 million. It can be for everything from a violent offense to a moving violation involving a vehicle, and of course everything in between. So the case before the court today asks the Supreme Court to determine whether the search of the cell phone that follows the arrest should first require a warrant, should require an independent determination by a judge or a magistrate after the arrest that the subsequent search of the cell phone is justified and will be appropriate in its scope.
So how could that work in the field? If you get pulled over in the way that this Riley was pulled over for a broken taillight or expired registration, and the police see your smartphone sitting there next to you, could they confiscate it and then get a warrant before they look at its contents?
Yes. One of the consequences of the arrest is that the cell phone would be seized by the police. But what happens next is the open question. The facts of Riley actually support the view that there is time to obtain the warrant before the search, because in that case, the police took the cell phone, brought it back to the station house, and it wasn't until a couple of hours later that they decided to go through it and look for evidence. There may be some circumstances at a crime scene where the police would need to look at the cell phone immediately. That's described in the laws as an exigency, but that would be viewed as an exception. And the question is, should the default rule be when a cell phone is seized after an arrest, should there be a warrant process first?
Well, it seems that a lot of the justices on the Supreme Court aren't necessarily very tech savvy. There have been some comments made by Scalia, for example, indicates that he may not be that up to date on these extraordinary advances in technology. But all justices surely use cell phones and understand them, and they must understand the technological leap forward where your average cell phone contains more data than the entire, you know, writings of all of the founding fathers, the Constitution, and half of the Library of Congress.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely correct. And I was at the arguments today, and I was generally impressed by the questions the justices asked, the exchanges with the counsel for both sides in the case. There was discussion about Facebook and Fitbit and Twitter and the cloud, and I think a genuine interest to understand how the technology operates and what the impact would be on police practice. But the larger point, where I think there was general agreement about the justices, is that even though all of this is complicated and rapidly changing, it does seem fundamentally different from the type of cases that the court had considered in the past, which might be a person's diary or their wallet, a cigarette pack, for example. Those are the kinds of searches following an arrest that the court has used as the basis for its prior case law, but they don't seem to be particularly helpful here when you're talking about a device that, as Justice Kagan today said, pretty much has everything about your personal life right there on it.
Well, in terms of then, are we dealing with the disconnect between when the Fourth Amendment was written and the current situation, or, you know, given that it was about the British occupation and general writs that allowed the redcoats to kick the door down and go into the colonial houses and ransack them, and the idea that you're supposed to be free in your person and papers, what is the parameters of that?
Well, I think the first point to keep in mind is that the Fourth Amendment is not about a particular technology that existed in the 18th century. The Fourth Amendment is about the rights of citizens and the limited powers of government and how those principles are to be applied in such circumstances as the search by the police for information that may be relevant in a criminal investigation. So we have, over many years, developed case law that extends these principles to new technologies. As I said, what's interesting about this particular case is that we're in an area of the law that considers searches that follow an arrest. And in that area of law, the Supreme Court has not yet had to consider the impact of new technologies. But I think the principles are very much in the forefront of the justices' minds as they think about how to appropriately apply the Fourth Amendment. And they certainly know that that provision of the Constitution creates a presumption of warrants, and even when warrants are not required, still requires reasonableness. So now they have to decide, is it, you know, conceivable that you could allow such a broad scope of a person's private life, far beyond, in fact, what might have been traditionally kept even in the home, by the police without that warrant determination.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Mark Rodenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. Now, it's pretty clear, though, that technology is rendering at least the idea of privacy in your person and papers, in the sense that we have now drones, and there'll be police forces will be using more and more of these civilian drones once the FAA gives them approval, and they have infrared capability and they can fly over your home and look into your home and see what you're doing. And there's been a previous case in that, has there not, where Justice Scalia was offended by the idea that you could take pictures of somebody's wife in the bath. So walk us through how that encroachment of technology vis-a-vis the Fourth Amendment.
Well, that's actually a very interesting example you gave. I was in the courtroom for that case. That was the Kylo case in 2001, concerning the use of a thermal imaging device by the police outside the home to try to detect the presence of marijuana grow lamps. And the question in that case, much like the question in the case that the court heard today, is whether the police should be required to obtain a warrant before they conduct the search. And it was Justice Scalia who wrote for the court and said that this is an intrusion into the home. It may be by a new device, but it's not a device that's generally available to the public, and the police should obtain a warrant. And I think, following from that case, it's quite possible that Justice Scalia, looking at the facts of this case, will feel as well that a warrant requirement is appropriate. Many of the examples that you're describing, the use of drones, let's say, for aerial surveillance or evidence gathering, are also likely to present challenges to the courts, and it won't just be the Supreme Court, of course. There'll be many courts across the country will be trying to apply Fourth Amendment protections to these new police practices. I think that's a very good and healthy process. on the one hand, the police will be looking for new ways to more efficiently conduct searches, but I think the courts will have the responsibility to draw some lines and say when the police have gone too far. There's a wonderful line I recall from another Fourth Amendment case going back almost 20 years ago involving the use of computerized record systems, and Justice O'Connor in that case said police should have the ability to take advantage of new technologies, but with that opportunity comes the responsibility of complying with Fourth Amendment requirements. And that's now become the theme, I think, for the Supreme Court in these cases.
But in terms of some of the arguments that took place today in the Supreme Court, Mark Rotenberg, there was a talk about how cell phones can trigger bombs, and talks of Faraday bags that are the devices which we can suppress the signals.
Well, the government has raised some of those, extraordinary examples in their briefs, but when they were pressed today for actual instances where police agencies had reported anything at all similar, they couldn't really come up with a concrete example. Now, the Faraday bag is a simple solution to the concern that while the telephone remains on a network, it could be accessed by other parties. So if you don't have the ability to simply turn it off or put it in airplane mode, you could drop it into basically a metal pouch that prevents any kind of transmission to or from the device. And many jurisdictions which do have a warrant requirement today for searches of cell phones following an arrest have actually established procedures for how to do that. It's not unusual at all when you're securing evidence at a crime scene to put evidence into marked bags to make sure that it's appropriately handled. Certainly a cell phone is going to be a piece of evidence, and you could put it into a bag that has this additional characteristic that it won't send or receive radio waves.
Well, one of the things about cell phones, though, is that as long as you have a battery in a cell phone, it sends out a ping to look for various towers so that it will operate. And this means, in effect, that you can be tracked in real time because of triangulation between towers. They can actually pinpoint your location. So not only does your cell phone carry, thousands, millions of volumes of information in it about you and about your past and present, but it also is a tracking device. Did that issue come up?
Well, it did. One of the points that was raised during the arguments today is that because the cell phone has a GPS capability and because that GPS information is stored on the cell phone, it would also provide to the police a record of where people have gone, which could be useful in some settings. But it also creates the sense that there is just so much personal information on that device that there should be some limits in place about the circumstances under which the police might be able to obtain access to it. And the GPS example is significant for the Supreme Court as well, because they had a case just a couple of years ago where they all seemed to agree that a GPS device which is attached to a car, again, should require a warrant before it can be used as the basis of collecting evidence in the course of a criminal investigation.
My understanding, Mark Rotenberg, is that news organizations filed briefs in support of these two cases of Riley and Woori that reached the Supreme Court and have brought out these incredibly important questions about the Fourth Amendment and the extent to which Fourth Amendment protections extend to your personal cell phone. So the fact that news agencies are supporting the defendants in these cases, arguing that cell phone searches can compromise news gathering, clearly would put me in the situation of supporting the news organizations. But what specifically were the arguments put forth on behalf of news gathering?
Well, news organizations are always concerned about the privacy of their communications and the confidentiality of their sources. So if you imagine a situation where a reporter who's in the midst of some type of investigative story is arrested, let's say, for a traffic violation and their phone is seized, information about the communications regarding the story they're pursuing, the people they've been in contact with, the contact information for those individuals as well is now in the possession of the police. And I think it's precisely because of that type of scenario that news organizations would say, before the police conduct a search of that phone, there should be someone else, the judge or the magistrate, who's able to make an independent determination as to whether that search is satisfying an appropriate legal standard. And as I said, typically in these privacy cases, we're not saying the police should never get access to the information. What we're saying instead is that the warrant requirement ensures that someone else is going to make the determination that the police have the right to get the access to the information. I also think from the law enforcement perspective over time, this is actually the better approach, because if instead of the warrant requirement, you set up a situation where the police are obtaining evidence in ways that could easily be disputed, then you're going to have a lot of suppression motions. You're going to have a lot of defendants arguing in court after the search and after the indictment that the search was improper and the evidence should be tossed out. So that's the the consequence of not following the warrant standard.
So in the end, you think that this might actually tighten up the rules
Well, I think it's a good practice. As I said, we're not ignoring the concerns that the government has raised in this case. We do think the privacy issues associated with the search of a cell phone are extraordinary, need to be given adequate consideration by the Supreme Court. But over time, anticipating how the law might evolve in this area, I think everybody will feel better about the outcome if we're able to make determinations pursuant to a warrant standard and not simply based on what might happen at a particular crime scene.
Well, Mark Rotenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Nice speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, as the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half past.